Hello, this is Tad here from the hit podcast Let Me Tell You About, and we're doing Bonus Boys for this month. Or rather, Guest Boys. Bonus Boys is a different one. I have so many boys now. I have Guest Boys, I have Best Boys, I have Guest Boys. Anyway, my guest for this month is a Mr. I'll go ahead and I'll let you introduce yourself.
My name is RJ Lake, or Robert J. Lake, as some of you may know me. Either way is fine. They're equally valid titles.
And the main reason that I know him is we both went to see Japanese pop star sensation Hatsune Miku in Chicago, and I did not know that he was there. Otherwise, I probably would have thrown some dumb shit at him because I was there.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, me and Alex, I went with Alex, who was not on this episode due to some dumb stuff, but I went there with my best friend Alex, and I was wearing a Doom t-shirt, and I saw on your Twitter that you were actually, you took like a selfie outside or something, and I was like, oh shit,
yes, I did.
Just missed him.
Yep. Yeah, you probably did. What row were you in, or what like area of the general thing? I was like right down the center.
I was aisle. On the second to left, so there was five aisles, I think. I was on the left side. I was on the inside of the left one along the aisle, and there was a lady behind me who would not stop screaming every time the little yellow boy was on screen.
There's a mom near me, actually, who clearly had no idea who Hatsune Miku was and what any of this was. And she was there with her kid who was like trying to explain the entire time what was going on. So that was really fun. That was exceedingly entertaining, actually.
Trying to explain every time the vocaloid, yeah, deepest lore.
Every time the music came down, she'd be like, "No, mom, so she doesn't actually, she doesn't exist, but people treat her like she does," was like actually a sentence I heard at one point. And yeah, I mean, that's pretty accurate. I can't dispute that one. No, I was just saying, I love Hatsune Miku, you know, I love a good Hatsune Miku trek, but I was really, my ulterior motive in buying those tickets was really there to see Anna Monoguchi, and that was what was really doing it for me. That was incredible.
Biggest takeaway I got from that was I was completely soaked because I drove up to the theater and realized, oh shit, I'm in Chicago. I have to find parking. That's right. I can't just stop here.
Yeah, you can't. Chicago is not built for car people.
No, it's not. That whole trip was actually a lot of fun. I wore a Make America Great Again hat. I changed it to Make Anime Great Again. And that was mildly funny until, oh fuck, whoops, shouldn't have bought that hat, my bad.
Yeah, I would say that probably, in hindsight, may have been in poor taste, but at the very least, he kind of tried to save it.
So. I think it was before he actually won, and so it was still like, ha ha, funny, okay. look at this douchebag. Anyway, so, RJ, you were a Homestuck musician.
I was. Sometimes I feel like I still am.
I mean, I guess it's something that you don't just stop being one. I mean, your songs are still there on the Bandcamp. They're still in the comic. You were on a few albums.
I was on the majority, yeah.
Yeah, Volume 5 was one there was a lot.
I started a little earlier than that. The first like official track that I did was or the first official track that got on an album was Carbon Nadsat Acoustic Genius on the Spade Slick Midnight Crew album.
Midnight Crew Drawing Dead.
Yes, yeah, that one. That was a lot of fun. It was actually it's one of the first. A lot of the tracks for Homestuck in the early years for me, it's all FL Studio. It's nothing else. No outboard gear. There's no MIDI controller or anything. But it's funny because that was that first one, I actually did use a keyboard to figure out the melody just because it was my first time attempting anything vaguely in the realm of jazz. Because the whole idea for it was that Andrew kind of like he roped all of us together and he's like, I want to do a concept album. Like that's like a band album of what the Midnight Crew would do. And I want to do like a dark jazz album was what he pitched. And he didn't really describe what that would sound like. He's just like, make it jazzy. So that was my first attempt ever at doing anything vaguely jazzy. And I guess for me, that meant Blue Notes and like 3/4/4 kind of stuff. Because it doesn't really, there's not a lot of improv on it. But yeah, no, I get, that's all about that track. I just talked a lot about one thing there, but that's the first one. And then I was on a lot of the albums after that.
There was always a, even when I was first listening through the track that, or the album, that one always stuck out to me as a little bit different than the rest. And I could never really kind of pinpoint why.
It's definitely different. And I think part of that actually is because the rhythm is a little unsteady. It's not that it doesn't really hold together, but the rhythm on the track is, again, it's set out in actually a 3/4 rhythm. Like it does fall into a 4/4 beat, but the FL Studio file was 3/4 time was how I set it. Which I think contributed to a weird wavering feeling. I actually really didn't know what I was doing at the time with time signatures because I didn't know a lot of that stuff besides the basics. Mm-hmm. Like I knew how to count into a time signature, but I didn't really know how to play with them the way I kind of do now a little bit more. And I was just kind of messing around a lot, but what really comes down to it with that first track especially, and with some of the later ones getting into it, is I think you see that I'm not really interested in making, like, I guess I wasn't ever interested in making Homestuck music as much as I was interested in making music for Homestuck, which I think makes a lot of my music sound a little weird in the context of some of the other stuff. Does that make sense?
The only one that I can think of right now that kind of falls into line as being normal for the album was I believe Jade Dragon from the Felt album, the kind of sequel right. to the Drawing Dead.
Right. And that one actually, that there's a reason for that. And that's probably because me and Clark Powell were the two like co-leads on that album. We kind of like invented the sound of it, I guess, that everyone followed. So like there's a bunch of tracks that we did that didn't get on the album that got used later. Like Afraid of the Darko was written for that.
Oh, really?
Everything is Something to Somebody was written for that album. Really? And then on Stuckholm, yeah.
Because I really enjoy that track, Everything is Something to Somebody.
Yeah, that was one of my favorites that I did for that album. I was a little sad that it didn't get used, but then I was happy it got used later. And I think that I was a little happier it got used later because it's one of my better compositions, and I feel like it helps to show, even if it's artificially designed, there's, I think, a pretty general upwards quality curve on my tracks in chronological order of release. So I think that I like that effect of that. But yeah, no, it was written back early 2010 before the album dropped. As kind of, we were trying to invent this sort of time twisting orchestral effect. And one of the reasons that I really loved playing with that was that I hate fake orchestral music a lot. I really, really do. It's not nothing against people who use sample sets, and I've actually gotten more comfortable with using sample sets over the years, like orchestral sample sets. But something about it always rang really hollow when I heard it, and I don't know what was wrong with my head about that, but whenever I heard like the Four Orchestra stuff, like the guy that did all those tracks, remember that big like boom when he was really popular?
Ah, that's right. He did Megalovania from Homestuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What else did he do? I believe he did Enter the Jungle, the Act 6 intro version, which has the fucking skeleton xylophone bit that I really love.
Yeah.
And he did one other one, I think.
He did a lot of stuff.
He did Rex Duodecim Angelus.
That was the other one he did. Nothing against him, but I could not stand his work. And it's literally just something about the sound of orchestral samples layered versus an actual orchestra playing them.
See, and I'm not a super knowledgeable music guy, and I also kind of see what you mean. I don't know if it's because they're canned sound effects, and you can only do so much to make them sound natural and collide with the other instruments, but it doesn't bother me that much, but I can tell.
That's definitely part of it. There's actually some tracks that are good enough to fool me that don't bother me. Like, what is the name? I'm going to look this up. There's an OC remix track in particular that is built to sound exactly like it's for a string quartet, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so flawlessly put together that it's impossible to tell that it's not actually a recording. Mario Likes Thorazine. It's by Schnabubula is the person who does it. One of the people I've always liked music from and wished that they did more. It is a flawless and really, really out there composition that's just a straight string quartet composition of the Mario Overworld theme, you know, the basic one.
The Mario really 3 produced. Or the normal Mario?
No. The Mario Overworld from like Super Mario Brothers 1. Like the
Boop, 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 boop.
It's flawlessly composed. And if more people put the care into using samples like that, I think that I wouldn't have as much of a I guess mental like disconnect that I have always had this issue with. But because of that, like to circle back from this tangent, I was really excited to kind of do that thing that I always hated doing and try to find a way that I would make it sound good to my ears, you know? So the trick basically for me was kind of emphasizing how fake the samples were.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of like looped samples that are used throughout. Jade Dragon goes so far as to and this is, I think, a pretty well-known thing at this point, and I'm not really worried about lawyers coming after me, but it samples the first string from Coldplay's Viva La Vida.
I got you now. That's, motherfucker, this was all a play. You're going down.
I'm going to jail. I wouldn't be going to jail at this point, probably. It would actually probably just be taken off the album. And that probably won't happen, because at this point, there's so many weird copyright infringement bits in the Homestuck albums. Like, there's that one Drop It Like It's Hot over Atomic Ebonpire, I think it was.
Oh yeah, where it's the slow.
Yeah, it's just like looped in for no reason, and then of course all the Nicolas Cage shit.
I was about to say the entirety of the Nicolas Cage song.
Like, there's a lot of stuff on there that, I mean, you could argue fair use. I feel like for me,
King of the Hill my arguments in Blind Prophet.
Yeah, my arguments would just come back to like, did you really tell before I pointed it out? I don't think anyone really did. And that's because it's like Paul stretched to oblivion and then pitch shifted and put back into its place. But, yeah, no, it's like, for me, it came back to making that artificial quality of those samples kind of foregrounded, so that you kind of lose the headspace of, oh, this is trying to be a real orchestra. That was important to me for that.
Yeah, that
whole I forgot album what the question was.
The whole album was a really fun, really fun group. There's a lot of silly songs, like was it Egg Sandwich, I believe, where
yes,
the track would go through, stop, you would hear, you know, a cassette recorder stop, replay, go through and add more and more and more. There was a few people who would take the entire songs and flip them backwards, which, from what I understand, wasn't how they're supposed to sound. There was, you know, a lot of
omelet sandwich. That's the one. Omelet sandwich. I was like, egg sandwich sounds right, but I wanted to double check. Yeah, that's a really good one. My favorite little tidbit here is, and this is part of like Clark and my, I guess, collusion in putting the album together. But so Rhapsody in Green, the entire track was composed forwards, and then just it's played backwards. Right. That's mm-hmm. what the track is. When you play it forwards, that piano line that you get is the lead piano line for the first segment of Variations. So It's like a little weird, not quite a palindrome, but like it's a little Easter eggy, and I liked that about that album a lot.
English came from that album as well, right?
Right, and okay, I might as well just talk about this because there's been a thing that I don't think anyone has ever mentioned about English, and the track before it. And it's, I fucked up when I uploaded the wave deconstruction of the full master of the album. And English starts like the actual track for English that Toby composed is 20 seconds into the file that plays in the album. That outro from the previous track became part of English, like, that's kind of like now part of it because of that fuck up, but it was my fault because I actually was like, I was in high school at the time and between classes I was editing the tracks. So I didn't really have a lot of time to go into and like, so I had to snippet them down. I was fucking like loading Audacity on a USB drive onto the, you know, public use library computers to do this. And I only had like 30 minutes between, during my like lunch break.
Is there anything more homestuck than that? Someone in their high school slapping together a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. Cause I mean, like people say when I tell them that they didn't really know, I think Toby wasn't really pleased about it at first. I don't think he minds anymore, but
I think he's a little too busy with other stuff to mind now.
He's definitely busy with stuff. Yeah, he's busy living his life.
Yeah, he's getting up to his own shenanigans. But so let's talk a little bit about Volume 10. So
Okay, skip ahead.
We'll wrap back up to Homestuck itself to talk about that and the ending of that. But we'll skip right past that for now. And so Homestuck ended on April 13th, 2016. And then, you know, there's a few news points like, oh, yeah, we got an epilogue, blah, 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 whatever. And one thing that I was really, really waiting for, I'm like, OK, cool. You know, Volume 9 just came out. I can't wait for Volume 10. He promised that's going to come along with Act 7. Where is it? well, what happened? Well, he didn't make a news post about it. It's probably going to be coming soon. I'm sure it's just going to come out in like a week or so. What the fuck?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think everyone felt that way, or at least to some degree that was like in the back of everyone's minds. Like it wasn't the primary concern, I don't think, but definitely I think people were asking about it.
Because you know, there was always a music album after every big moment, you know, Cascade came out, boom, you got Volume 8, I believe. Volume 8.
Yes. Yeah, no. 8 was Cascade. Cascade was on 8, and it was like the big separated like tracks thing at the end of that. Yeah.
So
that is accurate.
So how did the Volume 10 process work out?
So, wow. Okay, that's a bigger question than I think you'd expect, because the album, I mean, we had been talking about Volume 10 for years. I wrote this in the booklet that I put together for the album, but Volume 10 was literally 4 years after Volume 9. Like, think about that for a second. That's kind of nuts. And it was a few years after Cherubim. There was a lot of time between projects, and we didn't just like kind of sit around doing nothing during that time. We were just like actively making music and trying to figure out how it would fit together. But there was a certain point where it wasn't like one event did it, but the Homestuck music team sort of fell apart. Like, wasn't officially fallen apart. It wasn't over at all, but people were definitely kind of moving on. It was like a transitional process. Like, there were a bunch of people who were moving on to make music for video games. I know that around the time Volume 9 dropped, a little bit after that, Jeremy started, like, moving on to do some stuff for Starbound. Like, there was some, you know, Toby was doing all the Undertale stuff, like, right around 2013, Toby started, like, really hammering out Undertale. And he was not really, you know, with good reason, interested in doubling down and spending all his time on Homestuck stuff. So there was kind of like just a general, like, everyone is doing something else kind of thing, you know? And Andrew himself was worried more about the video game and the end of Homestuck, obviously. And those are much more important concerns, I think, than like considering when the next music thing, because that's always been a secondary project, when that would come out. So I think it was like December of 2015 when I really started kind of like more concretely talking and working on what the shape of Volume 10 would look like. There was already a thread in what is literally called the Secret Music Enclave, which is like the forum that Andrew set up for everyone in the music team. There was a thread that had been going for a while of what all the official tracks would be. And Toby, who was running the music team at the time, originally just said, just do 3 tracks each. Everyone gets 3 tracks. And that was kind of like the idea that I stuck to. So I started contacting everyone. And then a little bit after that, I really got really into contacting everyone. I think around April, like early April, late March, was when I started, like, by all means possible, I was trying to find as many members of the team.
Was it just because, you know, Homestuck had gone to sleep since, oh man, I think it was the 2015 in April, there was an update for a while, and then it was just nothing for a year, and then as April started going, I think it was, I remember the exact date, because my notifier went off, and I about goddamn flipped my shit, because it was April 6th. This was like 7 days ahead of schedule, what the fuck?
Yeah, right. I mean, that was, I think, definitely by that point. I think I had already started kind of like getting that ball rolling, but by that moment, it was full, go for me to try to get everyone involved. And I kind of ended up being like the de facto leader of that album, just because I was the one to get that ball rolling. But I didn't really start that way, right? I was kind of. What I did was I emailed Andrew, and I was basically like, yo, what's the plan for Volume 10? Because what I had pitched to all the people that I did manage to contact was, if Volume 10 isn't officially being released by Wet Pumpkin, because we had no word at the time whether or not it would be, we could just release it ourselves, right? Like, that was my idea. And thankfully, Andrew, like, the first email back within like 8 hours was, yeah, let's release Volume 10 on Wet Pumpkin. And he basically gave us carte blanche to do what we wanted, and he would just like review all the songs and make sure he okayed all of them. He kind of picked the 25 he liked the best out of the, I think the initial grouping was something like 50 tracks that we all submitted. So it was, you know, there's a lot that, and we knew, like, going in, I had kind of like decided, and I think everyone sort of mutually agreed that it just made sense for album 10 to have 25 tracks. Like, that was kind of an obvious thing.
Oh, son of a bitch. You know? I never actually realized that.
It's just a very basic, like, clear, it wouldn't make sense otherwise to all of us to do it any other way. So we knew we had to narrow it down to 25 tracks, and Andrew picked out the 25 tracks he liked the best, and we had effectively carte blanche to order them how we thought it was going to go best. I think, actually, I'm trying to remember if Andrew decided the order and we like edited it later, or if we decided the order after he picked all the tunes.
Yeah, but looking at the full list, I mean, you've got a very clear end song, but then whatever. Do whatever.
What I do remember, I mean, I had this kind of, we had ultimate control over the final product, at the very least, within those parameters of those songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of the songs that you hear have basically no input from Andrew in general, although James Roach, who is kind of like the liaison between Andrew and us, and like the Bandcamp page and all those things, was the guy who was kind of like our go-to, who helped us out a lot. He did a lot for us to make sure that the album came together, and he like got us some musicians that helped out with Marcy's big huge track like near the end, Renewed Return, which is like one of the most phenomenal Homestuck tracks. I think it was a lot of happy accidents, I think, throughout, that kind of just gave us extra motivation to make it as good as it was. Like, one of the big things that I was really happy about was getting Kurt Blakeslee back, because he hadn't done like anything for Homestuck for a while, until I just kind of pitched him on Facebook. I had to track him down. Hey, you want to do Volume 10? And he hit me up with two tracks, one of which was Beatdown DX. And Andrew picked Beatdown DX as one of the tracks. So it worked really, really nicely.
Blake, that name sounds familiar.
He handled Beatdown Round 2, and Beatdown DX. I think he did some other stuff, too. I'm actually going to look this up, because...
Yeah, while you're looking that up, because I do remember the first few tracks of Homestuck are very video gamey.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of blips and bloops, and I remember looking at the names of them and not seeing a lot of those names kind of show up later on. I don't know if it was just like, hey, here's a song, my dude, go ahead and use this whenever you want, and then, whoop, you know, like, all right, I'm going to go on and go do other stuff, or however that worked out. We'll get into that later, about the actual process of, you know, the songs getting chosen for the comic and all those.
That was kind of mostly hands-off for us. It was kind of an interesting process, because what, by and large, the Homestuck music choosing process was we made music, we threw it in this, like, kind of secret forum that was just, like, a private forum Andrew set up, and Andrew would just pick songs he liked from that.
Now, I know that there was a little bit, there was an issue with a man by the name of Bill Bolin that was related this whole process. There's some kind of like hazy answers as to what was going on there. From what I understand, and I don't know if you, did you ever have to actually sign like kind of a contract or anything with Andrew for how he would choose your songs and things like that? Or was it just, you know, hey, you have access to this group, anything that you put in here? Because from what my understanding of the process was that Bill Bolin made some tracks and put them in there, but they were work in progress tracks. And then Andrew chose one of them, put them in there, and Bill did not like that. And it was kind of, it was a whole situation there.
Andrew chose four of them, and Bill was angry that Andrew didn't, I think the quote was that he didn't let Bill realize their full potential, which seems, I don't know. There was a lot of stuff going on with that guy that seemed like he needed help. And he wasn't getting any help, but he was channeling it in a really destructive way. And to be fair to him, I feel like a lot of the people at the time, and at least me speaking for myself, I didn't handle that well. Like, I was being very sardonic with, like, I'm a sardonic guy. I'm a very sarcastic dude, but I was not handling guy who needs help, like, I was definitely, I think at least in part of the whole blow up that he had, because I wasn't treating him with any degree of empathy. That's entirely like my own like remembrance of this, but I wasn't egging him on or anything. I wasn't like being a huge dick, but I definitely wasn't on the, I wasn't on his side, and I'm not really still on his side.
And I mean, you also have to take into effect, this was like, what, 2009? This would have been 8 years ago. I mean, you would have been in mid high school.
Yeah. Oh, God. I keep forgetting that it was that long ago. Yeah. It's,
yeah. Homestuck's almost a decade old, my dude.
Holy Christmas. No. Yeah. I mean, I was an idiot in high school, obviously. But even owing to that, he handled all the stuff badly. Like, Andrew did was use his music a lot in the comic, and it's because Andrew loved his stuff. The whole situation is kind of, the reason that a lot of people don't talk about it is because there's not a lot to talk about, frankly. Like, really what happened was one guy blew up because Andrew used music that he didn't want used, but no, Andrew didn't know he didn't want that music used. And from that point on, there was kind of a general understanding among the people who were left that if you posted music in the forum, you know, and it was like an accepted thing that it would probably, if it got used in the comic, that was like an agreement that if you're posting music in the forum, then you kind of consented to that. And that was, I think, something that nobody really questioned before that was that event happened. No one really thought otherwise, but it was made more explicit after that for sure.
Yeah, because I imagine it was the, you know, I'll choose this and not tell you just to keep it a secret, you know, keep a secret of what's going to happen in the future for everyone.
And there was no, it wasn't like, knowing how Andrew works, because anyone who works with Andrew Hussey knows that there is zero, like, malicious intent when it comes to that kind of stuff. There's no way that he was, like, trying to usurp the artistic statement or whatever that this guy was putting forth, but he saw it that way, and the ensuing argument was not a productive one. That's really what it comes down to. And it, you know, it sucks. I feel like it could have gone better, probably. And with hindsight, I would have probably treated it differently. But God, 9 years ago, I was 15 years old. So who the fuck knows what I would have done? Yeah.
But back to Volume 10, how Volume 10 was for me was, because the ending of Homestuck was like a super big, important, like, emotional moment for me. And that was because Homestuck was a really big part of my life. It's fucking 7 years. Seven years spent. Exactly. And so, because the ending of Homestuck, it sure was a thing. I'll put it that way. And Volume 10, and I want to personally say thank you for helping put that together, because that, like, felt like, okay, it's finally over. You know, Volume 10 has happened. You can close the book on Homestuck now. It has that conclusion that I was lacking from before. And that made me feel a lot better. Oh, man.
Thank you, yeah. I mean, yeah, we were trying to make, for us at least, and I mean, I guess it's part of why it has that effect, because you're not the first person who said that. It definitely was me trying to close that book emotionally for me. Like, it was me finishing up what I was kind of, there was a lingering question mark for me on Homestuck as a project, I guess. Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, Stockholm Syndrome is the same thing, but Volume 10 was making that, like, explicit and official. That this is, like, the last Homestuck album. And that's why I definitively write that it's the last Homestuck album in the little booklet, and Andrew definitively writes the last Homestuck album. It's, like, it's done. It's over. We can now kind of move on. And I think that a really nice thing that Andrew did was using the one of the songs that Tensei wrote for the actual, like, end credits bit.
It was Ascend, I believe.
Yeah, and Volume 10 ended up folding back into the comic that way, instead of just being this entirely ancillary thing. Although, I mean, when I say ancillary, I'm not saying that it's unimportant. Rather, I'm saying none of the music was used in the comic before that point. So
It was entirely new stuff. It was apart from. That's kind of the word, the usage of that word that I'm trying to get across. But yeah, no, it's definitely, I definitely treated it as an emotional palate cleanser, I guess.
Yeah, because everything that's come out past then has been all related to Hive Swap and the Grubbles, mm-hmm. different stuff like that. You know, Homestuck's done. And then speaking of Homestuck finishing, so let's roll it back a little bit and let's talk about the ending of the comic Homestuck.
Okay.
So how did you feel about Homestuck as a let's talk about the first kind of section of Homestuck. Let's leave Collide and Act 7 off to the side for now. How do you feel about Homestuck as a whole kind of there?
Homestuck as a whole is a more complicated feeling. I would actually separate it further because for me, Homestuck is like three bits. There's acts 1 through 4, which to me are like, that's what Homestuck is. That's how I feel about it.
I agree entirely.
And then there's act 5 and like the first bit of act 6, which is like, that's when Homestuck started getting really huge. But that to me kind of, I started admittedly at that point checking out a little bit. Not so much like with the comic, although that's true too, as with kind of the whole thing in general. And that's really more related to where I was in my life at that point. We're talking like mid 2011 or so, right? I had just finished high school and I was going into college. And the general feeling was kind of one of uncertainty, I guess. And Homestuck didn't feel the same for me reading it. So I'll be honest completely and say that for several years, until much more recently near the end, I wasn't reading Homestuck at all, even while I was making music for it. Just because it wasn't something that was like part of my routine anymore. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was something that I had kind of fallen. And the, probably the lowest point for me was, that's really telling about this is I had to use the Homestuck Wiki to write songs for Cherubim. Because I didn't know who those characters were. Yeah, I had no idea what those characters were.
You missed out on the best character in the comic, Caliborn.
Yeah, no. I mean, no, I finished it. I read the whole thing after that point. But, yeah, no, I checked out at that point for years. And I kind of, like, had to ask my girlfriend, because she was still reading it actively, what everything was, what to keep me kind of updated and in the loop. So I knew what to do to write the music for it. So that was like, that was the process for volume 9, and Cherubim for me was like kind of like having her help me get in that headspace so that I could kind of accurately portray emotions that I didn't myself experience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
I had kind of a similar experience myself where first 4 acts, you know, I was super crazy into it. Act five was when I caught up. That's when I started reading. Okay. I remember the exact page because it was Aridin jumping out of the way of a bunch of shitty wands coming out of his fridge. And then from there on, I was every single day checking it, boom, boom, boom. And then once it was a little bit into Act 6 when it started going through the Alpha Kids that I kind of started, you know, checking once a week. And then, you know, every now and then I'd check it until eventually just...
Right.
Just like, right. This is, I'm not feeling it anymore. And then I came back around, oh God, what was it? I think it was Game Over is when I was like, oh, hey, this is, or it was the build up to Game Over with all the wacky meta stuff of splitting the website into 2 bits and doing all that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's some cool stuff. I always clarify when I talk about this, I don't even think it's necessarily a lack of or like dip in quality as much as it was a confluence of like a variety of factors that for me personally it just took me out of it, you know. I think I was kind of feeling a little weird about how hyper successful Homestuck had just suddenly become. I had sort of
accidentally lucked into being a part of this giant phenomenon that I was very much like the inner circle part of, but I also felt like really kind of removed from it at the same time, because I wasn't really, as even though I was a part of that group and a part of that team, I never really talked about Homestuck, and everyone else seemed like hyper into it, you know, to the degree that I was when I started. And for some reason that just kind of like exacerbated the feeling to the point that I was kind of disassociating a little bit. So that was kind of just a weird point in my life, I think, is what kind of happened.
You think it might have been, I mean, and I'm trying, like, you know, what is it like? Just something like a little bit of jealousy, maybe, for people who's like, oh, their music got chosen to be in.
I mean, definitely there was a part of that. There was a part,
you know,
of
in
that.
In the background doing albums, not necessarily one-on-one, you know, my stuff's in the comic, you know, I'm right here now in this big thing.
Right, I mean, like, but that's only, like, a small part of it, honestly. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna be dishonest. I definitely was a little jealous of some other people who got more, I guess, play. But if you look back at all of the music released over the albums, and I really think that the albums are kind of like the best chronicle of the music for Homestuck, because that's what people listen to, that's like what people bought. I have some of the most music in the comic among all the composers, or not, if you count the comic, the albums as part of the comic, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just not getting into the flashes and such as much. And so I don't look back on that with any kind of real jealousy, because I honestly, I kind of made out with like a bandit there. I have not even a joke. I am incredibly lucky to have as much music as I have on those albums. And it really was a product of how much music I actually made, because I was pumping those songs out like constantly. There was a 3-year period where I would make 10 songs a day sometimes, just like endlessly. And then I would like stitch tracks together and like throw things away and then like come back to them. It was a very, very creatively fruitful series of years. And that's why there's so much of it. You know, that's why Stockholm Syndrome has 400 songs.
See, the most music I've ever made was I opened up FL Studio and I drew that stupid loss meme, and that was about it. So that's my contribution. I also put a MIDI of, Showtime. I put a MIDI of Showtime into like a Casio keyboard and it sounded like complete garbage. So that's what I've contributed to the musical side of Homestuck.
How did you get a MIDI of Showtime? Like, or was it just like one of those online?
I don't remember how I got it. I might have gotten it. It very well could have been like a shady back alley deal where someone slipped a 20 under there and got a MIDI.
If you throw MIDI data into a Casio, it's just going to play that. But I mean, I don't know how many channels you're trying to shove through a simple Casio sound chip.
I'm going to play it through some garbage instruments, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, this is getting into some music nerd talk, I think, a little bit, or more music production nerd talk. But
I do have a question about some more fancy schmancy Music Man stuff.
Okay, yeah, no, shoot.
This is a question from a fan of the show named Kibo, and they were wondering what your position on musical analysis was, since some musicians, composers, seem to believe it's a bad, bad, terrible thing that should never, ever happen.
Oh, no, it's a good thing. I don't think criticism of any kind is bad. Like, I don't know why a composer would ever think musical analysis was a bad thing. I think that you can do bad musical analysis for sure. Like, if you're looking at a track and trying to analyze the composer's intent without having any context, that might be a little bit presumptuous. I get death of the author in that sense, but I do think that, like anything, musical analysis is a tool. Like, you can use it correctly and use it badly, really, is what it comes down to. Some songs will
kind of you'll be able to like appreciate more of the complexities that they do, I think, if you come at them from that point of view. And other songs, I think, especially tracks that are more built from a textural or production oriented standpoint, music analysis tends to fail them, because if you approach it from a traditional compositional look at things, you're a lot of the time textural approaches to music can be so simple on paper from a compositional standpoint that it looks like there's nothing there, or that it's like overtly simple. And I think that that's really why a lot of people don't like musical analysis, but nah, I'm for it is really the ultimate answer.
All right. I've got a few other ones just kind of from people. I in the Discord for the podcast, I put a shout out. I put it on Twitter for people to submit a few questions in, and I kind of picked and chose as I went through here.
All right.
I've got a kind of a general one here. It's from a friend of the show, Prole, or Prole. They never answered when I asked them for clarification, but it's just a really general, you know, what was your, you know, who were the people that inspired you to make the kind of music that you make? You know, who do you look for? And like, yes, I want to be like them.
Oh God. Yeah, no. This is a good question, but it's also a really hard question. And it's obvious for anyone, like anyone who does anything, if you ask them their influences, this becomes terrible. I'm going to link to it and see if it's still online. I got this question years ago when I started Tumblr, 2012. And what I did to answer that question was I made a mashup of like 32 songs that I really liked. I'm going to try to link that.
Would you say that's still current, or have you...
It's definitely still accurate. I mean, it's not necessarily current because I there's more things that I've liked since then. The usual boilerplate, like the first two that come to mind anytime someone asks this question are Daft Punk and Gorillaz. Like Damon Albarn in general, but very specifically what he does for Gorillaz stuff. Because Gorillaz was like the first time I really started listening to music, like with an ear tuned towards it instead of just kind of passively. And so much of how I think about music was, it comes from like 13 years old, listening to the first Gorillaz album, like in bed over and over again, just kind of like really trying to pick out the sounds of it. There's a lot of really out there hip hop and dub influences that kind of coalesce into that first album. And that was always a huge, huge influence on me. Another one that I always kind of love to touch on is the music for the Powerpuff Girls movie.
I vaguely remember it.
Yeah, no, it's a really good score, and it's one that I feel like people don't appreciate as much, and part of that is unfortunately that it never really got an official release on its own. It's one of those movie scores that I feel like, because it was for this kids movie that didn't really do that well at the box office, it has a 63 on Rotten Tomatoes for some reason, because a lot of people just didn't like it at the time. It came out sort of around the same time that movies like Lilo and Stitch did, that The Emperor's New Groove did. It was like in this weird early 2000s animation climate right after Shrek came out and Monsters, Inc. came out, where CGI was kind of seen as this new vanguard. And even among films that were current, that were 2D animated, the Powerpuff Girls movie kind of like looked to a lot of critics as this sort of weirdly vintage, backwards facing kind of thing that was just this odd object that didn't do much. But it's a great film, and it has a really great score, and I strongly recommend checking it out. There's a... I think it's Girls Day Out is I think the name of the track, but there's this one I'm gonna link that too. Oh, there's a bunch of people who uploaded tracks from the Fun Day at Home. There we go. I'm gonna just throw that right.
Speaking of uploading tracks, I think the actual reason that we kind of got in contact was there's a game that you're working on, and one of the other people working on it. I actually and this was after Volume 10 came out, and you put out the first kind of volume of Stockholm Syndrome, the very first iteration of it. And I actually took them, and I'm like, oh, these are really cool, but I want to share them easier. So I'm going to, like, throw them up on YouTube and make sure, you know, like, oh, I'll link them all up on there. But I'll just put that on YouTube right there. And then somehow Jack found me through that. And then that whole kind of spiraled out from there.
Oh, my God.
But, speaking of those things, we'll just keep jumping left and right all over the place here.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah,
we'll leave back 7 to the very end here, because I don't want to talk about it, but I will. So Homestuck's over. Volume 10 has come out, and then what is your post Homestuck music career been like?
Oh my God, pretty haphazard. Like, I'm doing a lot of solo projects, a lot of which I've been keeping pretty under wraps, because and this is a thing that I think Stockholm Syndrome bears out, just because of how much there is. I do a lot more music than I show, because I'm kind of this hyper perfectionist mentality that it's kind of my least good quality. I think I have a tendency to kind of the Apple Mac like approach, where you really only reveal something when it's completely finished. That approach has fared well for me in the past, but also fared pretty poorly sometimes, because it looks like I'm doing nothing a lot of the time. But I mean, like, there's a bunch of solo projects. Like, there's this rap album I'm working on, among other things. I did Songs for Rune. That was one of the big solo albums that I've been working on for 5 years now, that I finally finished. I obviously the Stockholm Syndrome stuff that was kind of like just thrown up there. In addition to that, though, it's been a lot of video game soundtracks. Some of which I can't talk about, but I mean, the one of that you're kind of like egging on is there's a lot more to it, but currently the like working title is Gossamer. One of the other ones we're floating around is Blossom Road is the kind of the name that I've got like floating around in my head.
Yeah, I believe I was introduced to it as Oblivion Genesis was the current project name.
Yes, Oblivion Genesis was the current project name at that point. Before Jack, kind of talked to me about this game, like at that moment when I kind of came on board the project, it was called Meridian Legacy. But whatever the name is, it's now a game that I have gone from composer of to lead on, and I am like it's kind of been this really interesting whirlwind. But all the music for the entire like first act is done. It's already like got 2 hours of music done, and that was a huge part. Yeah, it's a huge part of my last year, was working on just the music of it while writing the script. I would go back and forth, because they kind of informed one another, where the script would kind of help me think of a musical approach, and then how the music was coming together would make me think of new moments, or like maybe change a line this way, or, you know, different things like that. And that was the entire last half of 2016 was basically me working on the music for the game. Just,
and I have heard one or two tracks, and they are pretty slapping beats.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's some of the best music I've made. Like, I'm not gonna pull punches on that. I really think it's like some of my best work so far. And I mean, that's just really that that's how it should be because it's some of my newest stuff. I feel like if I'm not making better music every day, then that's a problem probably. And I would have to like look at that. But yeah, no, it's some music I'm really proud of, and I'm really excited to like just finally show it off soon, hopefully soon. Other than that, though, there's a lot of other projects I'm working on, which also I would say I would categorize as some of the best music I've ever made. The big one that I think you know about is Bulletin.
And I actually, from what I saw, I followed the developer on Tumblr a while ago. I don't know if he's the main one or the only one or what that kind of situation was, but I think he was working on some kind of Homestuck small game. And he took the system from that, I believe, and started putting it into this other game, and then just kind of shifted gears, tossed the Homestuck to the side, and was like, hey, this game's cool, and started working on that one.
What's funny is, even though I kind of vaguely knew about him from the Homestuck fan game stuff that he was doing, because, I mean, even though I wasn't really keeping tabs on the fan base that much, I encountered the forum every day. Like, I looked at that every day. So I was kind of like, through osmosis, I knew about his stuff. And he obviously knew about my stuff through Homestuck. But we didn't meet through that. We actually, it was over TigSource, the indie game devlog website, where I saw the project he was doing, and I vibed with it immediately. Like, Bulletin is this really cool... like neo-noir punk thing that's all done in very crude MS Paint drawings. And I initially wasn't that into it until I saw how it moved. And it's one of those things where you have to like really watch the way the game moves, like the motion, the animation of everything. Have you ever seen the movie We Are the Strange or any of the other work of M. Dot Strange, he calls himself?
No, but it sounds familiar.
It's like a Hot Topic, incoherent version of Ready Player One, but somehow that sentence is a good thing. I don't know how else to describe it. Like, it's really, really weird, but... And it's knowingly weird, which is usually a turnoff for me, but it's also sort of enthralling. Anyway, way off topic. That's kind of the same vibe that Bulletin has, except Bulletin has good writing on top of that, like really good dialogue writing. And I really like the tone. Like, I was just like, I messaged the guy, and immediately, like, I was part of the project like the next day because we just sort of hit it off. And I'm doing a lot of, to like circle back to the whole Gorillaz influence, that's really been my biggest kind of touchstone for that game sound, which is this very dub oriented late 90s electronic kind of, I'm just trying to like find this very odd,
it's the I would describe it as the music that when you look at the game you think it would sound like that, because the game, from all the things I've seen, is very dark, very gray, very scratchy.
Yeah.
Bulletin boards that people posted on in the late 90s, mm-hmm. early 2000s, what you would hear in someone's auto-playing signature.
Yeah, yeah, that's actually a pretty good way of putting it, because it's very early 2000s in its, like, the cultural touch points I've been listening to kind of, like, get myself in the headspace for it. A lot of Fatboy Slim, you know, a lot of Chemical Brothers, early Boards of Canada, and then, of course, Gorillaz. Yeah, that's stuff like that is what I'm trying to do.
So those are the kind of the main two game related projects that you're able to speak about.
Oh, there's actually a few more. There's a few more. Ooh. I've been basically, how long have we gone so far? Over an hour at this point, and I've maybe answered two questions, which is I think par for the. Whenever someone talks to me, this ends up happening, because I'm very bad at answering questions and I'm very good at digressing. There's a lot that I'm excited about, but the other one that's like really coming along and like is almost ready to release and I'm super excited about is Muddle Dash. And Muddle Dash is I actually represented it at BitBash this year. I was kind of like, because the other two devs are in other places way all over the world. Like, we got a guy in Scotland and a guy in Australia. And the... I think that's accurate. They'll probably kill me if that's wrong. But so I was like somehow right smack dab in Chicago where they had wanted to unveil it for this public event. And so I went down there to show it off. And what it is this four-player competitive racing 2D platformer where everyone's an octopus.
You play as the octopus, you jump around, you squirt ink, and then you just, you make sure to mess other people up as you continue to the right of the screen to get whatever the objective is at the end of the area, or just to get to the end and not be,
That's pretty close.
In last place with all the losers.
There's no ink squirting, but you can kick them in the face with your tentacle.
Okay. And do you control
the tentacles, kind of a weird
Octodad style? Or is
normal,
it just a
normal character motion, character, although the physics are like intentionally a little floaty in a fun way to kind of like make you feel octopus-y. And when I say that, I mean like they're really, really like... the game has like this like really slippery motion to it that's really fun. And there's all these like little gel slides that you kind of like jump on. I'm trying to think of like the closest game analog, because there's not a lot.
It sounds to me a little bit like that game Ultimate Chicken Robot Horse or something like that, where it's a platformer.
The one little wrinkle I haven't mentioned about the game, by the way, is you have to carry a present to the end of the level to get invited inside to a birthday party. So the player who gets to the end with the present is the winner. If you are the first to the door and you do not have the present, you are not allowed in. So you have to be the one with the present. So that's like the fun little wrinkle, and you have to kick the present out of like everyone's hand and make them suffer with your, you know, tentacle snapping.
I see now. So there's one present between four octopi.
Yeah, it's fun. It's
okay,
fun.
Okay, now I'm piecing it together here. And when is this game just about done?
It's really close. Like,
or is it done?
When I say just about done, I'm talking like the build we had at BitBash 3 months ago was effectively final polish for the main mode. Like, there was a few things missing, but it's like mostly final polish on that. The only thing really left besides working out release details and a few other modes we're working on is for me to finish up the music. And I kind of have to like book it on the next month and a half to just really, really buckle down and get all that done, because I have to, you know, it has to be good, obviously. And it's been one of those projects where I've made a lot of music that hasn't been good enough for the project, you know? Because despite the tone sounding very happy and silly, which it is, it's one of those things that has such a polished aesthetic that an unpolished sound doesn't cut it, you know? So yeah, that's the whole thing. So I've been working really, really hard, like overtime, trying to make the music as special as it possibly can be. I'm actually like, I think I can show some stuff from that soundtrack, but I'm gonna err on the side of caution here. What I'm gonna do, pretty soon though, what I can say, because it was publicly discussed, on one of the TIG Source Discords, there's going to be like this one big mass update post on the game pretty soon, and I'm going to be sending some of the newer final tracks to the way of the two devs I'm working with on the game, and they'll probably like just drop those in with the big update post. So yeah, that should be within the next like week, because I'm going to be sending them that stuff tonight. So the other big one is Halt. I don't know if you know anything about that one. That one is currently, it's slow going, but not, you know, too slow going, because it's one of those games that 90% of it was finished, and the last 10% is like most of the dev time. And that I'm kind of approaching sort of a Hotline Miami style, really thick, like bassy house stuff for Halt. Mega Man levels with Cave Story shooting is how I would describe it. There's like, I think 30 weapons you can unlock. It has a very, Adventure Time style food system where you can combine ingredients to get better health power-ups. But yeah, it has this system where, right, so you put like salt on a hamburger and the hamburger's better. But if you put like peanut butter on the hamburger, it like makes you lose health. So you have, yeah, so that's like,
oh, I see.
And it's very, pretty obvious, although you can get creative, obvious. And then like for example, chocolate covered fries, those are a boon. So you want to like experiment a little bit, but you can like make really nasty shit and that loses health for you.
And I'm sure there's secret recipes for things that end up like you put two things that sound gross and then, oh, like, you know,
that
and
for
chocolate.
Here is,
oh, no,
actually the,
a thing. You know?
Grape jelly pizza item is one of those.
I have a feeling that someone on the dev team discovered that and has been very, and they've taken every opportunity to rub it
in
people's face.
Try this great
pizza.
And the other one, the last one I can talk about, because I'm just going to talk about them all so I can get them all out there. Because I know that it's not even that I want to talk about all the stuff I'm working on so much as, I know if I leave something out, the people I'm working on with the project I left out will end up like being like, yo, why didn't you plug that one? You know? Oh, God.
Yeah, you're off the project, RJ.
The other big one, and it's much more recent, and it's actually with the guy who is going to be now the programmer on whatever we end up calling Gossamer, is a game that is called Space Punk Slam Dunk, and you can actually play the prototype that was done from for Ludum Dare, a while back. That prototype is called Bawab, beating aliens with oversized balls. You can just type in Bawob. And the first result is, I believe the first result is that.
What I'm getting just from that name is I'm getting an NBA Jam mixed with Disc Jammers style game where you've got a bunch of wacky, crazy stuff going on.
Well, shit, you're not actually that far off. It has there's an NBA Jam kind of aesthetic. Not even an NBA Jam so much as like the type of announcer shit that I really want, which is adjacent but very related, is like Sega Rally. Like, you know the Daytona Sega games? Like, the Game Over Yeah vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm going for. Yep, yep, yep.
Something like that.
But the idea of it is you are this little girl who is on this alien spaceship, and you have this like infinite supply of basketballs, or it's not really there's game mechanics here that I'm glossing over, but when you have the basketball, that's like your main mode of attack. So you throw the basketball like a dodgeball, but you can also use it to double jump, and you can use it to kind of like solve puzzles by like putting it down on, you know, sensors and going through doors that way, stuff like that. The whole game is built around using the basketball creatively. And then at the end of the level, each time you win the level to like exit, you have to do a slam dunk on a backboard. So, yeah, it's very fun. It's very fun.
Good.
Other than that, I don't think there's any other projects I can really talk about. I'm doing something like a little piece of music and maybe more music for the game Glitched. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but not like a lot of I'm not really that involved with that project, at least not yet. I know that they have a really talented composer who's working on it right now. Shout out to Justin, who he's a cool guy. He's a really cool dude, and he promised that we would play D&D, and that never happened. So we gotta fix that. And that's all the games I can think of for right this second that are motoring, at least right now.
Yeah, honestly, right, if I'm gonna be totally like fully on honest, I think that whatever editing you do to this podcast, the majority of it is going to be cutting out extraneous shit from that last section there. Because let me tell you, there's
no the oh, dunk God. Slam Integra. Is.
I think I went on for 20 minutes.
Entire episode here. If we don't, I think I went on for 20 minutes because there's like what's seven the projects point?
That I'm involved in that I had to equally shout out to. So we can probably speed that up quickly somehow.
But let's go ahead and let's steer this boat back to what we skipped over before, and then we'll go ahead and we'll start working towards closing out this episode here. So let's talk about Collide and Act 7. So from my point of view, Collide was fucking hell yeah, let's throw it out. It's original Homestuck. You got them strife battles. You got that beat-em-up aesthetic. You got shit going crazy, 90 miles an hour. You got to rewatch. I think I've watched Collide 12 times. And I know because it's 18 minutes long, and I did the math. So I've watched it 12 times. And every single time, you know, I always found something hidden away. Collide was awesome. It was fantastic.
Oh.
Act 7 was disgusting.
Wow.
That's my opinion.
Why?
Act 7 disgusted me. It was the highs of Collide, followed by the lows of Act 7. Oh, oof.
Damn, why? See, because here's my total full-on, like, again, as I was fully, like, admitting of, I came away from Homestuck, and I wasn't really that into it for a while. I thought Act 7 was really awesome. Like, what struck you as so abysmal about it? Because it's lovingly animated. It really does a nice emotional close note on the whole thing, and it manages to, like, it implies that there's this giant endless cycle, which I think is what Homestuck is all about anyway, is like this endless cycle of rebirth and death. So I don't know, I thought it was pretty fitting myself
for the animation. Definitely the animation was very well done. You know, the musical score that went alongside it, really, really well chosen. The reason it... All right, so remember how I mentioned I've watched Collide 12 times? I've seen Act 7 exactly twice. One time I watched it, and then I genuinely thought, like, I clicked on a wrong video or something, so I watched it one more time, and I never watched it again. So the reason that Act 7 struck me so bad was it felt like an ending to the comic circa 2013. If you went right from Cascade to, you know, you condense some of Act 6, you know, with all the Alpha Kids, and then boom, you got Collide right there. The reason why, or Act 7, the reason why I went through legitimate stages of grief. It hit me so bad. It was because it felt to me like, okay, all of these, you know, all these plot, you know, I was hyping up like, okay, there's all these different plot threads, all these things. I don't expect them all to be, you know, I don't expect this, you know, whatever this update is to combine everything in Homestuck and have it give a, you know, big old stamp at the end. But I expect, you know, like, here's some core things that were brought up and then they were never addressed. Like, because I remember the exact experience too, because I was watching video like, okay, this is awesome. All right, Frog's flying towards Skaya. Oh, there's only 3 minutes left. oh no, oh no. And that's what it was to me. The reason it struck me so bad was because it hit me and it left all these open things, and it felt like none of the past like 3 years mattered. None of the things that were brought up or happened in there had any real impact to anything. I will admit that when the epilogue happened with the Snapchats, that did tie up a lot of things and make it much, much better. If that would have happened right after there, where it had the actual credits scene, that, because there was a lot that was just left completely open that didn't really make any sense and took a lot of interpretation. But once the actual, you know, when he had those end credits through the Snapchat stuff, that did tie up a lot of it, but it still felt like a kick in the nuts.
Suffice to say, I don't feel like that at all, but I think also I respond in, what is actually interesting to me, and it's something you brought up, is this is something that a lot of people felt, and I don't think I respond to narrative, I think, the same way that a lot of people do, because to me, all the like tiny like little end strands of a plot thread being tied up is vastly secondary to an emotional arc being fulfilled. And a lot of what I consider some of the best narratives that I've experienced don't ever really tie up their loose ends. Honestly, like, I feel like a lot of the loose ends that were tied up were things that you could kind of like imply from just like, it's the logical conclusion. You don't really need to be explicitly told those things. So I came away from it like, oh yeah, that was like a pretty satisfying conclusion to something that at that point I had sort of had a reconciliation with, and I was coming back to with a very positive light. So maybe that's part of why I was looking at it so positively, but I really didn't have the intense negative association that a lot of people did. I don't know.
I think a big part of it was a lot of Homestuck was small. It seemed to me, at least as I was reading through Homestuck, cause I've read through the comic.
Oh, wow.
The entire comic, I think 3 times. I was big into it. There was a lot of things where there would be a small thing that was just kind of left open, and then later taken back, oh, this thing that I left open, now that was actually connected to this thing. And when you do that with a lot of different things, it kind of sets up this anticipation that, oh, the Cairo overcoat that Lord English had that tears when space-time rips, that's got to be important. You know, that one line about... you know, English only being able to be, you know, I don't even know if it was in the comic or not. I think it was on the forum spring where he said Lord English is based off Lord British, who could only be killed by a glitch. There was a lot of small things that were chosen to be made into a big deal later on in the comic. And then the ones that weren't were just like, well, what the fuck was that? And then, you know, stuff like certain characters ended up in really awkward situations, like Carcat in the end, his whole character arc. There was a lot of things that felt like they weren't finished, or, and I honestly believe this here, that I think Homestuck was like kind of it changed from a fun project to, this is kind of what I have to do here. I want to finish this thing now and move on to something else around like 2012, 2013. After all the stuff that went on with the Kickstarter and all the personal issues that were going on, I think it kind of changed gears to, I'm not having as much fun with this as I used to. So I'm going to, I'm going to keep adding all these things, keep my interest in it, and then just try and get this over with. And that's, it felt like a turning point. And then from there on, it seemed like everything that was kind of added was kind of superficial. It's kind of hard to explain, but I think I was too hard on it to say, you know, like, oh, like this was complete garbage. You know, this is the fucking worst thing I've ever seen in my life. Cause you know, there's obviously a lot of work that was put into that last flash, and Collide had every single thing I ever wanted right before it. You know, that's everything I wanted in Homestuck Flash. So I shouldn't be that mad, because I got what I wanted, you know. And like I said, once the Snapchats came out, you know, okay, this is actually what's happening. You know, this is why, you know, this is why that thing is there. And there was a lot of small stuff. And plus, you know, like I had a huge, huge, you know, Homestuck was a huge deal to me. And then it was just like, nope. All right, there we go. Act 7. And there was a lot of, like I said, a ton of small stuff that was amplified by how close I was to the comic and what I had a lot of different like explanations, like, oh, you know, expectations of how this was going to go. And it hit none, and like none of those were even remotely correct. So I think there was that kind of resentment coming from me as well.
I mean, that's I guess all, that's all fair. I for me, for my part, and this is not like a judgment call on anyone, least of all you, of course, but for me, I've always felt like the wrong way to watch or experience media or read a book was to kind of like nitpick all the tiny little details. Like to me that's like stuff that you do after you've already like taken in a work and like you've enjoyed it enough, you can kind of like start picking it apart. But I've never understood, I guess, on a deep level why someone would watch, say, like a TV show like Gravity Falls, for example, and then like spend all the time ever, always looking at like the tiniest frames of the show. And I love that people do that, but it's never been my thing, you know? And so I guess what I can understand, like if you're coming at from that standpoint, if someone comes from that standpoint, when the ending kind of like doesn't really address those points that they thought were much more important than they ended up being, that can feel disappointing, right? And that's part of why I feel like I've always like, yeah, felt like that was a self-defeating way to experience media. Because, but then again, as I said already, I look at things, or I experience things much more from a like deep-seated emotional level. I really don't come at media, at least most media, for narrative details as much as, yeah,
like
I'm not looking for
a logical, like, this happened.
I feel like logic is what I look for in documentaries. You know, and I'm not saying that to be like, no, I'm not saying that to be like pithy or jokey. I look at a documentary and I want it to tell me something very logical and deep. I literally look for things that are not logical in stories. I want something that has logical character, emotional beats and logical character interactions. I don't want characters to feel like they're random or they're not people, but I don't want the ins and outs of the narrative to feel like something that necessarily could have happened in real life, because that's personally, for me, not what I go to fiction for. And I mean, there's a lot of fiction that does that really well, that does really realistic stuff really well, but I've always been drawn to more operatic things. So I don't know. I guess that's why I really wasn't bothered by it at all. But a lot of people were. Like, a lot of people were.
If I had to say one last thing about how it was for me, I think it was because for the second half, like, because I was big into the first four acts, you know, that's what I was there. I'm here for the obtuse faux video game mechanics given physical form in here. I'm here for Psylodex shenanigans. You know, I'm here to see Dave call a skateboard a riding stick device in order to put it in his inventory. That's my jazam. That's my shit. And so I'm like, okay, yeah. First 4X. Hell yeah. Fucking love it. Woo. Doctor, give me that shit. Lands, you know it. Classfex, you got it, fam. And then, you know, Act 6 started and 99% of that was shoved off to the side, but it would still show up every now and again. You know, like, oh, hey, here's this really cool, interesting mystery. Because, you know, the first 4X were mystery.
Yeah.
Who's this guy in the robes? Why is he talking to them? Where is this, you know, what's this thing? What is this green? Why did he eat the fucking uranium? And so I stayed onto Homestuck for those snippets that would show up every now and then. And I think I was really just expecting that all to come back in one big, huge, glorious thing, which it did.
Yeah.
But I also
wanted
totally it to
happen fine.
Again.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
I mean, it's a trip for both, you know, both different perspectives, as someone who was a part of it and someone who was just an observer like me. was important. It's added a lot of stuff. You know, there's fan stories, fan albums, you know. I didn't get into any of those Act Omegas or Act Eights where people started writing
that,
their own
ends. Yeah,
of the
that's
comic.
That's really
that
like
seemed
overdoing
a little excessive
it
for
to
me. Yeah, that seems like that's a little too much once you start literally writing your own end to the comic. But yeah, I think that'll do it, and I want to thank you for coming on to the show, RJ. It was a lot of fun talking to you, letting me yell about Homestuck for a little bit. Alex
no,
never
it was a lot of fun talking.
It, so I can't do it there.
Sorry if I rambled too much or like didn't answer enough questions.
Nah, you're fine. I think we got
hit all the beats
we needed here.
Yeah,
all, you
perfect.
Know, we hit all the big notes and it hit all the beats like a music person. And if you want to go ahead and put in your plugs here, we'll have, you know.
All right, both all right, all right. So, I guess so. Plugs for me are just check out my the Twitter, which is where I talk things. It's at Spellbang. And then if you go to spellmynamewithabang.bandcamp.com, you're going to see all of my music for sale. Definitely check out Songs for Rune because it's the newest thing I've put on there and it's pretty good. It's like hyper chill out music. And yeah, those are like the main things are those two. You can like really see all the other stuff by just typing Spell My Name with a Bang into Google and like everything comes up. But yeah, and then check out Muddle Dash because that's the one that's like really coming out soon. There's going to be more stuff on that very, very soon. And look at Bulletin. And the game that I'm personally like actually directing and working on and writing right now, whatever we end up calling it, doesn't really have a final name yet, but I'll be talking about that very soon on the aforementioned channels. So, you know, you stay tuned on that.
For let me tell you about, you can find us in the normal YouTube, iTunes, Google Play, on the website, which is, you know, www.lmtya.com, or their preferred URL, which is letmetellyouabout.moe. This was our bonus kind of guest podcast that we do every month due to all the cool
goal.
Dudes on Patreon.
Smash that like.
Goal. And jump in the air at the end of the Patreon goal and fucking dunk slam that shit. Anyway, so yeah, that'll do it.
Not
and,
a problem.
Once again,
thank
like,
you for having me
on the
here.
Show, RJ.
So, yeah.
And then I'm not sure how to end this one, so I'll just make a fart noise.